Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up, I went to the Endometriosis Conference in Dublin last weekend to meet the experts and people pushing for more support for those with this debilitating disease. A new report published by DePaul and the Mental Health Reform reveals the growing intersection of homelessness and mental health issues, which underscores the urgent need for systemic reform. And I'll be joined by Aisling Hassel, who went from top of her game in the tech world to sailing around the world to fulfil a lifelong ambition. And when retirement just didn't fit the bill, she started a wellness centre, which she hopes will become a chain around Ireland and beyond. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I'm good. We had Mother's Day. We've brighter evenings. There has been much to smile about this week. We did, me and my family, have a blow of sorts lately. I don't even want to call it bad news because there's so much of that about right now on a far worse scale on what I'm going to tell you. But we reached the end of a very long, very drawn out planning permission journey with a no. Now, one of my friends remarked over dinner recently that I didn't seem as devastated as she thought I might be. And you know what? While it is disappointing, of course, I would love more to be in the celebratory mode, obviously. But I am finding this energy of knowing what we are doing much easier than the limbo that we were in for so long. I also got our news on the day one of my other friends received a rather scary diagnosis. And while I know she'll be fine, it really does put things in perspective, doesn't it? So we are fine. We are house buying in a housing crisis. But look, aside from that, there are people far off worse than us. Now, I got a good few emails from you about my interview with Dr. Susan O'Sullivan last week on her book, The Age of Diagnosis. Some of you made contact with me with concerns on the topic of neurodivergence. Some of you felt that the questions Dr. O'Sullivan posed about how perhaps not every diagnosis for people is helpful to them and their quality of life was not in keeping with the movement towards inclusion and understanding for all. Neurodiversity Ireland also released a statement outlining their disappointment at the messaging within the book. And in the interest of balance, I'm going to read some of that. To be neurodivergent is not to be broken or a label to fear. Often it is a turning point for self-understanding and connection with others. The increase in identifying neurodivergent people reflects many things: a growing acceptance of difference in society that until recently overwhelmingly valued conformity, increased understanding and better knowledge among professionals who realise that difference shows in many more ways than was first realised. You can read the full statement on their Instagram page, which is at Neurodiversity Ireland. Now, I'm not reading this so that I can then argue with it or take it down, but I take on board everything that was said and the emails that were sent to me. But my understanding of the book and our interview is slightly different in that I felt Dr. O'Sullivan was asking questions about how things are done and how best that serves those with a diagnosis and those seeking support. But there is no question that this is a highly charged, sensitive topic in its infancy of being understood and fully inclusive, though much work has been done by great organisations such as Neurodiversity Ireland, and I can see why they might feel that questioning it at all undermines how far we have come. You can let me know your thoughts. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, a new report published by DePaul and Mental Health Reform reveals the growing intersection of homelessness and mental health issues, underscoring the urgent need for systemic reform. While one in five people in Ireland experience mental health difficulties, the situation is far worse for those experiencing homelessness. The report reveals that at least one in two residents in DePaul services are struggling with depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts. A crisis hidden in plain sight. Director of Services Dermot Murphy with DePaul joins me in studio now. Dermot, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Claire, and thanks for having us.
And this is a cry for help, not only for the people experiencing homelessness and experiencing these mental health issues, but for those trying to help them because they're not getting the supports they need.
Oh, no, absolutely. Like what we're talking about from DePaul's perspective as a homeless charity, we work with people from Derry straight down to Cork, Galway to Dublin, and our staff are at the call face. We're seeing young men, young women coming in either with chronic mental health conditions or being in homeless so long that they start to have exacerbated mental health conditions, and they are not equipped to deal with that at all on the front line.
And what happens if you meet somebody like that who is saying that they're feeling any of those symptoms? What do you do with that information?
Well, first thing that we do in DePaul is that we ensure that we have staff who are trained to put in place what we call case managers. They put in place support plans. They look to signpost people to services. But as you'll read in the report, you know, 4% of our service users who are having mental health issues are getting access to psychiatric nurses, and less than 10% are getting access to counselling. So it's a really uphill battle for us in that. I think what we tried to do was put in a support plan, ensure that we look at putting in place supports around their day-to-day activities, stuff that will try and mitigate against their mental health or other issues that they're coming to us with, as well as look for supports outside of the service itself.
And there's times where you feel your support services are almost used as a dumping ground.
Well, we're the front line. Homelessness is usually the last point in someone's journey. And a lot of the time what we're seeing is people that are moving into homelessness because of addiction, of mental health, of family breakdown situations. There's clearly a failure in the system somewhere if the result of someone with a chronic mental health condition is they're ending up in a homeless service. You know, so it can't be anything other than a dumping ground if we're running out of resources to support somebody to stay living independently.
And when you look at the statistics, I mentioned some of them in the intro, as did you there, we would be shouting about this a hell of a lot more, I think, if it was a national crisis, which it is. This isn't just a homelessness crisis. This is something that impacts all of us. And the thing is, though, we are shouting about mental health and we are saying the resources aren't there, people aren't getting the supports they need. Do you feel that those experiencing homelessness are being considered to be far down the pecking order?
Those in homelessness are significantly more disproportionately disadvantaged by the situation. You said the stat yourself. We're talking about one in two of our service users, and this is based on data over a 5-year period of 4,500 individuals. One in two are identifying that they have depression, suicidal ideation, anxiety. When you think about that in the general public, that's one in five. It's clearly disproportionately affected in homelessness. So in simple answer to your question is yes. I think homeless people, by the very nature of homelessness, have a greater disadvantage. You know, we think about homeless people, they are marginalised. They're in a situation where they don't have their own home. A lot of the time they can have various issues going on. One of the things we found in the report is those that have dual diagnosis, which basically means a mental health issue and another issue such as addiction or behavioural issue, find it harder to get supports because there aren't dual diagnosis services. We already know there aren't mental health services. So a lot of the people in homelessness are people that may have addiction, mental health, vulnerability, social isolation. So they're going to be disproportionately affected by any situation that's developed for the general public because they end up being outside of those general supports.
So what would you like to see? What changes would you like to see come in?
Well, look, we know the Mental Health Bill is going through at the moment. We think it's a good opportunity for the resources to be identified and put in place to support all people with mental health, but specifically those in homelessness. What we'd like to see is an increase in supports around, you know, better access to psychiatric services, nursing care counselling, as well as peer-led programmes. So DePaul provide programmes which are persons with lived experience supporting people in homelessness to access and advocate on their hospital care. We'd like to see more of that for our mental health service users that have supports needed around that. You know, so there are a couple of things. The other thing we'd really like to see is that trauma-informed practice and trauma-informed care is funded adequately across all of the sectors. We know that people coming into homelessness have trauma. We know that homelessness in itself is a trauma, and ensuring that the staff on the front line are equipped to identify that and support people around that would make a real difference.
Because there's a real human impact behind these statistics. Obviously, the statistics give us the impetus to have these conversations, but people need more than just a roof over their head. They're going to need to be supported through this experience, and that will benefit all of society.
Yeah, well, look, I think the reality of homelessness is a lot of the time we see homelessness as the lack of a roof. Homelessness is inextricably linked to health. We see people in homelessness, they age prematurely. And we have research on that that shows people who are in their 40s, when they go and get tested, have a physical age of 60, 65. You know, so we know that these two things are inextricably linked. And we know if we can improve them, what we do is we give people a better opportunity to move on in their own lives. So one of DePaul's values is we celebrate potential. Okay. The people we work with are full of potential. And we fail them if we don't provide them with the resources to meet and exceed that potential. So, you know, I think that absolutely will have a massive effect on our society. We know that when people move back into their communities, they become part of the community, they do better, they reduce their need for health inputs, which is a reduction on the exchequer. We know if they're moving out of a homeless service, it's a reduction on the exchequer because there's less beds needed in homelessness. So I think overall, if we can put in place the resources to ensure people can live independently, then we'll have a better society collectively.
Yeah, and it's certainly the one I'd like to live in. Well, DePaul Director of Services Dermot Murphy, thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks so much, Claire.
For more, you can go to depaulcharity.org or mentalhealthreform.ie.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, my next guest has had an incredible career getting to the top of her game in the tech world to ticking off a lifelong ambition of sailing the world. Aisling Hassel returned to Dublin to retire, but on a beach walk with her husband, she said, "This can't just be it," and decided it was time for another venture, a wellness centre called DEA, which launched this year. And Aisling joins me in studio now. Aisling, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much. Great to be here, Claire.
Now, we know each other. The wellness centre, thankfully, that you've opened is literally on my doorstep. But you told your story recently in Life magazine, and I thought people need to hear it because it's pretty incredible. So, Aisling, did you always have a career plan? Did you always see yourself ending up in the C-suites of the tech world as you did?
No, I would say I didn't have a concrete plan. So I did mechanical engineering in Trinity, mechanical manufacturing engineering, and then I did a master's in fluid dynamics. And after that, I really decided academia probably wasn't the path I wanted to go on. So I took my first job, which was a sort of a strange one for an engineer, was sort of editor of an engineering database for a US company. And it was their first sort of location outside of the US. So that launched me into basically a career of management, because I went straight into managing a team of 23 and sort of a baptism of fire, really, straight from college. But and from there, I just, you know, I moved into the tech world with Symantec, and, you know, I didn't have a plan like where it would end up. But I suppose I did the Barack Obama sort of method of just get stuff done. And so became very collaborative and very sort of focused executive, if you like. And through that, you know, I suppose I always put my hand up for opportunities. So there was an opportunity to go to LA at an early point in Symantec, and I took that. Went to LA, and the fact that I was sort of in the US and close to headquarters, which was in Cupertino, which is about an hour's flight away, just meant I could see more opportunities and I was more visible. So I took all those opportunities and then sort of migrated from, you know, I suppose manager level to director to VP. And then at some point decided I want to come back to Europe, and took a job in the UK, actually, in this kind of semi-migration back with my husband and our kids. And then, you know, took a job, I took a riskier move, moving to Airbnb, which was my last gig. And that was riskier because it was a very new startup. I hadn't really worked in the startup world before, but it was an awesome opportunity to see a company grow from the grassroots, really, and to build a team from basically the ground up. So no, there was not a plan, but I suppose just kind of a built on reputation.
Over the years, have you noticed, particularly working in a startup, is there more of an emphasis on workplace well-being?
Oh, I think so. And I think it's probably not just isolated to startups now. You know, I think every firm is realising that looking after people's well-being is good for the firm and it's good for everybody that's in the firm. So, you know, I see it in lots of business, not just startup. Now, I will say, you know, in tech startup, you are very much nurtured and looked after, you know, whether that's nutrition. You know, the founders of Airbnb were very big on diet. And so they had a dedicated food program, which they personally, you know, curated and made sure that the diet that people were eating was healthy and sustainable and locally produced, etc. And then, you know, in terms of well-being, yes, they, you know, I think so many firms now are supporting well-being by either sponsoring membership to clubs or, you know, we had, you know, a therapist who came in, I think twice a week you could sign up for, you know, a neck massage or a back massage to combat, you know, everyone's shoulders that are up around their ears. And so, yes, I do think there is focus, but I think it's getting broader than just the startup world. I think tech kind of set the bar early, but I'm happy to say that I'd see it much more pervasively now.
So when did this sailing and crewing go from being something you did as a hobby to something you decided you wanted to ramp up to the maximum?
Well, I think it was a two-step process. So I think going back to the career. So at Symantec, I was a VP. I was doing a very challenging program, which was to unite about 10 other sort of sections of the company around a commerce lifecycle, which was basically about redesigning the way we went to market to service customers. And so that was quite a large undertaking. So I did that program and basically got all the agreement. I think it was like a $13 billion program, just to put in context. And at the time, then I was asked, would I lead it? Like, would I run it? And I was like, oh gosh, no, that is not what I want to do. So I actually took a career break then. And, you know, sailing, as I said, had always been my outlet. And I had this in the, like, I do background process a lot of things, you know, like there'd be noodling there and I would talk about them. And I always thought, like, God, wouldn't it be fun to sail across the Pacific, you know? So my first foray was I took a career break and my husband very generously offered to mind the house and our son and pay the bills while I went off and sailed from, at that time, Florida to Tahiti. And he joined us along the way. That just kind of really just re-energized me. You know, people worry about taking career breaks, but I was a far better person. That was 6 months, basically. Far better person when I came back off that trip. And so that kind of showed me, like, yeah, you can take career breaks and it's okay and, you know, it's all good.
And you can say no. I really like that. Was a massive opportunity and they obviously had faith in you to do it based on your performance. Mm-hmm. But you kind of said, no, you know, I don't necessarily need to take that step. That's not the right one for me. And no is not an easy word to say.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, especially as women are more inclined to say yes all the time to any opportunities. And to be honest, like I did put my hand up a lot previously. And I suppose you get a bit of wisdom from doing that. So, you know, I had, like I said, I had one where I put my hand up to join a startup within the bigger company, which, you know, I would never do again. It was an absolute nightmare. And that didn't work out too well for me, you know. But when this came along, I think you need to listen to your intuition, because my intuition was, I am not going to enjoy this one iota. I knew I could do it and I knew I'd, you know, it would be a great success. And I'm sure, you know, I don't know, maybe more success would have followed that. But I was just like, no, it's not for me. So I do think you have to listen to, you know, what your body and your mind is telling you when these things come up and say, and but like sometimes don't be also, sometimes the fear can take over. So even as you're listening to yourself, there's always a little voice that goes, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. That's too risky. But I think you kind of know in your heart of hearts, and you do need a support network, you know. So like, for example, you know, in any of those decisions, it's good to have somebody to bounce them off, you know, and certainly I've been lucky to have that support just to say, am I mad or should I do this? And, you know, and just get a little nudge.
Back to Dublin, mm-hmm. and Howth you came. And tell us about that beach walk then where you thought, retirement, I don't know if I can do this.
Well, so we were back and we had finished the trip and we, you know, as I said, we live in Howth, so quite, and we had a dog, Sully. So it would be quite frequent, you know, practice to kind of take the dog out, walk up to the village, have a coffee. And that, it's a lovely thing to do. Like, we're very fortunate to be able to do it, like, as often as we like. But when we were, my husband retired at the same time. So I retired September 2020 before the sailing trip. And so did my husband. So we came back from the sailing ship. And when you're doing one of those trips, like, it's full on. Like, you, there's not an awful lot else you can take on to occupy your mind, but it's very absorbing, which is great. So we came off that, and we were, you know, trying to, we were like sit in the house by sort of some empty nesters at this point, because our son had gone to college, and Hannah had got married and was living in Malahide. So we were, you know, we spent a lot of time together, which wasn't new because we had been on a boat, like, in, you know,
and survived
10 square meters. Yeah, I know, actually got on really well. So that was all fine. But we were walking on the beach. I think, like you're saying, was probably day five doing it in a row, and like walking down, and it's kind of the same conversation every time. You know, look at those apartments, and oh wow, look at the beach. And that's when I turned to Darren. I said, well, this can't be it. And in the background, I had been noodling this concept around wellness, which I had, you know, talked ad nauseum, I suppose, over the years while I was working still. Like, oh, wouldn't it be great to have somewhere that you could go to that did this? And the operational head of me was always kind of thinking I could do it better, and how would I design it, and, you know, if I was going to do it. So that's kind of had been background processing, and then just, you know, really put my, decided I was going to really do the full on effort to get it up and going. And that's what, as you said, brought it to fruition, like opening and launching towards the end of last year and this beginning of this year.
So it's called Daya, which mm-hmm. is a culmination of all the names in your family.
Mm-hmm.
And what is its concept?
Yeah, the concept for Daya was really born out of the challenges I faced, and I think everyone faces, in trying to nurture your wellness. So, you know, when I came back from the States, you know, you would say, oh, where could you get a good massage, or where would you go for yoga? And it's all word of mouth, or, you know, is there a good reflexologist, or where'd you get acupuncture? And so it was all this word of mouth and trying to get bookings with people like over WhatsApp, etc. And I was like, gosh, it's really hard, you know. And so the concept is really that we would bring all the modalities for well-being under one roof and create this haven at the heart of a community to do a couple of things. One, to teach people about well-being, to nurture their well-being, and really to inspire them to kind of live happier and longer lives. So we have, you know, the concept then that evolved into, you know, the purpose of the brand is really to transform lives. So the other observation I had just from my practice, both in the US, honestly, and here, is that it can be quite transactional. Like, you can dip into an expert or a therapist, and you dip out, and it's like you're kind of been and gone, you know. And I just felt it was important. Like, wellness shouldn't be occasional. Like, it should be part of our day-to-day, you know, life, really. And how do we make that easier? So that's where, you know, we want to transform lives by being there constantly for people, no matter where they are in their wellness journey. So we have everything from treatments, and the treatments span east-west treatments. So we've everything from acupuncture to Reiki, reflexology, massages, to classes. And so movement is one of our pillars of wellness. And so movement is so important for your ongoing wellness. So we do everything, again, east-west, Tai Chi to Pilates to Barre and yoga. And then in terms of teaching and inspiring, we can turn the studio into an event space, really. And so that means we can do events and talks. So we did a great talk last night on endometriosis. So it's just a part of that education to the community. And then we do consultations. So I think a bit like yourself, and because of my background in tech, I'm very data driven. You know, I think being informed is a good thing. Not to agonize over the data, but really to kind of know where you're at. So the consultations are all aimed at giving you a benchmark on where you're at. And they span like sleep health, gut health, and also fitness age, which is basically getting markers of how you are doing on your strength, your mobility, your body composition, and most importantly, your VO2 max. And so all of that is really to inform you about where you're at, really, and with a goal that then you can go and either, you know, improve where your benchmark is through nutrition, through exercise, or through other, you know, through supplements or other means that, you know, we will help you kind of figure out. So that's the concept. And so far, so good. Been really well received.
Well, you have transformed the old bank. It's gone from somewhere we would grumble and queue to somewhere, as you say, we can emerge more relaxed. And I hope it does grow and more people can get access to it. If you want to find out more information, you can go to dayawellness.com. It's spelled D-A-H-A, dayawellness.com. Aisling Hassel, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, endometriosis affects roughly 10% of women and girls globally. That's 190 million of them. It's a chronic disease associated with severe, life-impacting pain for which there is no known cure. The average wait time for diagnosis is 9 years, and much of this is attributed to women not being listened to and told to accept their pain as part of their period. The impact this can have on their ability to work, get an education, their relationships, their mental and physical health is enormous, and yet not enough is being done in the areas of research to find out why this happens and how best to manage it. Endometriosis Ireland held their annual congress in Dublin last weekend, and I went along to meet some of the people who are pushing for change. Serena Massey is CEO of Endometriosis Ireland.
So Serena, you are one of the main organisers of today. Why was it important for you to have this conference?
Well, first of all, it's a great opportunity to sort of tell people that we have a refreshed brand coming. We have, you know, extra life in the charity because they've now hired a full-time member of staff, which is me. So it's really important that we get the community excited again because they feel so alone and so unsupported, and I totally understand why. But we've never had the ability to actually, you know, do much based on volunteers only running the charity. So it's great now to have a full-time member of staff being me, just focusing on all the things we need to do to make a difference. So today is critical on that journey to let people know what we're doing, to let people know who we are, put faces to the names, and to the whole theme is called Connection. So it's to connect the community, connect the experts, bring the whole thing together, because without all of the stakeholders on board being committed, nothing will change. So we need everyone aligned.
And you've been brought on board not only for your skill set, but you have a personal connection to endometriosis.
I do. I have lived with endo most of my adult life, and I put up with it, as probably many people have. We just thought in our family we had really bad periods, and it was all the women were affected, cousins and aunties and my mum and everything. But for my daughter, who now has it, and we're going through the whole diagnosis stage and the laparoscopy waiting list, I'm much more, what's the word, pushy about her care than I was about my own. And I see that with a lot of people, the next generation coming. We don't want our daughters or our, you know, nieces or anybody else that we know or care about going through what we've gone through. And I think that's driving us really hard this time. It wasn't good enough for us either, by the way, but, you know, we've had to survive, and we have. But we're not going to accept it anymore.
And because of the chronic pain, this impacts so many areas of anyone who has it. So as you're saying, education, work, relationships, social life, mental health, it just ripples out into all areas. So what are some of the key things on the to-do list for Endometriosis Ireland that you're calling for?
So definitely the framework to be published, because that's a starting point for people. So that means when you notice these symptoms, when you feel that you need extra support, that it's not just a bad period, that you're actually not able to manage day-to-day tasks, you know where to go, and the GP most importantly knows the process, and it's a clear pathway for a patient to follow. So that's step one, and that's something we're working tirelessly on, and hoping to, you know, work with all the key stakeholders to make that possible. The next thing is, we would love to be able to support the community more than we have been. So we would love to be able to provide a support line service. We get an awful lot of people contacting us in desperation for help, for guidance on where to go, what to do, should they go abroad, should they have a hysterectomy. Lots of people who don't know where to turn and don't know who to trust. So a care line would be amazing to have. And we already have a nurse who volunteers with our charity, but we only have a certain amount of time with them a week. So we need to develop those services. We are going to be starting a support service a monthly support service with a dedicated counsellor. So it'll be a support group online, and that will be kicking off in April. So listen out to hear more about that. And we are going to be hosting a huge event at the end of the summer, where we are hoping to raise funds to kick off a huge year next year, where we can dedicate time and resources to research, to education, to raising awareness, to working in partnership with corporates, to working in partnership with the government. We want to bring the HSE into the future. We want to provide information for the new HSE app. We want everything geared around the younger people and the people who are suffering with endo, so that we can make access to information and treatment much easier and more accessible. So that's a lot of information that we would like to do, but we're only starting. So we're learning, and we want people to tell us what they want as well, so we can help.
So I'm Dr. Kleena Murphy. I'm a consultant obstetrician gynecologist, and I'm clinical director of the National Women and Infants Health Programme.
And Kleena, what can you tell me about where we're at in Ireland when it comes to the treatment of endometriosis?
Where we are now is we've established two super regional centres, so sub-specialised centres in Cork and in Dublin, in Tallaght, down the road, where complex endometriosis it can be dealt with regard to surgery. So there's specialised radiology, there's specialised colorectal surgeons if required. So the whole multidisciplinary approach is really important. Then there's regional centres which have endometriosis teams, and it's very important that besides the surgeon, you also have specialist nurses, you have dietitians, you know, and ancillary services that support the patient, because we do know it's a journey, and it's a chronic disease. It doesn't necessarily just up and stop for all people. So that's made a huge difference. The other thing that has been happening in tandem is an improvement in access to actually getting to be assessed, you know, was a big barrier. And that's, we've seen that in the UK, and in Australia, that's been identified as well. So one way that you can improve that is by, you know, expediting that access to care. So the journey from a GP to see a specialist to be assessed and have endometriosis considered and explored as a possibility. So I can say that, you know, even in the last number of years, that really has improved. So looking back to 2021, 20% of women on the waiting list for gynaecology were waiting more than a year for access to gynaecology services. So fast forward to 2025, you know, there's about 3% are waiting more than a year. So that's made a huge difference, because not everybody knows that they've endometriosis on a waiting list. You know, the important thing is to get there and be assessed. So that has improved access to care overall, has improved access to care for endometriosis sufferers. So, you know, we need to keep that up. We need to develop some of the regional centres and get more of that support for the multidisciplinary team. But I can say with regard to specialised services, in 2024, over 1,200 patients were seen in specialised services, both regional and super-regional services, and there's, you know, dozens of complex surgeries performed every month within the dedicated services. And from the HSE perspective, you know, the funding that has been allocated has been, you know, 4.5 million. So I suppose from the policy perspective from the Department of Health, you know, it has translated into, you know, whole time equivalents of nurses and doctors and dietitians working specifically to improve care for patients suffering from endometriosis. What I would say, there's more to do. I totally acknowledge there's more to do. And one of the issues that endometriosis patients would say, that even after surgeries, pain can be an issue. So that is something we will need to address, is to have a kind of a framework for pain services and build that up in the country. Other positive developments would be, we've recently published endometriosis guidelines, and they're available on the HSE website. There's been a lot of, you know, clinician education, peer-to-peer support, strengthening ties between clinicians, and just really talking about how best to optimise services. And I know GP colleagues have done the same with endometriosis being discussed at webinars and courses and online learning that they have. So all of that adds to improving the care for the individual woman.
My name is Konstantinos Kyriakopoulos. I am an endometriosis surgeon based in Athens, Greece. Our job focuses exclusively on treating endometriosis. I have personally abandoned obstetrics or treating other gynecological conditions. And at the moment, we run the busiest endometriosis center in the southeast of Europe.
And a lot of Irish people travel to you for surgery.
Yes. The last years, there was an increase in the number of patients coming from Ireland. But also from other countries worldwide too. So problem of patient care is not only in Ireland, but also in other countries. In Greece too, it's the same everywhere.
And why did you want to specialize in this area?
In order to go and pursue a career in endometriosis, in treating endometriosis, I think all of us endometriosis surgeons, they had something specific that triggered this their decision. In my case, when I was a resident, we had many girls that came every month claiming that they have pain. So when I went to the hospital and I saw the same patients coming again and again, I asked the senior registrars, what's going on here? And they told me, okay, don't worry, you will know who these girls are. They are coming for years, but don't pay attention to them. They probably want, they're crazy, or they want to get some days of work, something like this. So I believed them because I was a junior registrar. But as years went by, so I came closer to these patients, and I saw that they were educated people. They had academic careers. They were not random people. They had PhDs. They were very educated. They had families. They were mothers. So something was not right. They couldn't. All these girls, they couldn't be pretending to have pain. Something was wrong. So at one point, I had one of these ladies that came again when I was on call. She was in a terrible condition. And she asked me, she told me that right now that we are talking, I cannot stand up and I feel that the inside of my abdomen is burning. Do you believe me? Of course, I couldn't say that I didn't believe her. She was not crazy, I knew her. But on the other hand, if I told her that, yes, I believe you, I would have to tell her why she's in pain, which I didn't know. I didn't have any explanation for that. And that was my trigger to dive into the world of endometriosis.
So what are some of the changes that you'd like to come in when it comes to endometriosis care that would help patients and you doing your work?
I think the last years we have been hearing more and more about endometriosis. This thing, I don't think it's a result of our effort, doctor's effort. It's a result of patients' effort, who push for a change. And what I would like to see, people that go to their GPs, they say that they have pain in their period, and the GP right away sends them to an endometriosis specialist. Because when someone, let's say that I go to the GP and I have a fracture in my knee, they will send me right away to the orthopedic. They will not tell me, take this medication and we will see if your knee is fixed or heals. But we will get there. We will get there. And events like today's conference are very important.
Ruthanne, you've just sang your new single, The Way I'm Wired, on stage. That was a big one. That's the first time you've sang it live in front of an audience.
Yeah, that was my first time singing it live and I cried, obviously. I got through, I was like, I can get through it. And then I just, some of the lines, they get me every time, even listen to it. It's hard for me to listen to. It's the most personal song I've ever written. So it was very vulnerable. I kind of felt like I was standing there naked, very exposed. And because it's the Endo conference, it's all my people, it's all my community. So yeah, it got me a bit emotional. But hopefully I got most of the performance without crying.
The words speak for themselves. It's all the things you've had to say no to because of how you feel.
Yeah, it's really a song for me. It's a song that represents exactly how you feel when you're in that endo flare up, when you're in that pain. And it's that moment in time. And so for me, sometimes that's very hard to explain to people, especially when I look fine on the outside and I've got my makeup on, my hair done, and they'll go, oh, but you look fine. Oh, but you sing fine. Oh, but you're doing fine. And I think sometimes with endometriosis, people don't understand it's an invisible illness. It's inside. So I can look fine, but not be fine at all and be very, very sick and not able to move. And I think this song hopefully is that song that people can find themselves in and feel seen and heard. But also, if you're struggling to find the words, send it to someone and say, this is how I feel.
And as you say, on the outside, everything looks fine. And you've got so much going on, from Irish Women in Harmony, people see you at the Brit Awards, you know, and then you're really putting yourself out there with this. You did an incredible photo shoot this week where you had body art put on to show what it actually feels like on the inside. On the outside, I mean, you do bury your soul through all of your music anyway, but how does this feel, being this vulnerable?
It's very scary, because I don't want to be, I'm not a victim of it. I don't want people to think, oh, poor you, you're sick, get over it type thing. But for me, it's too important to not. I meet so many women, I get DM'd by parents of 18-year-olds that are in leaving cert year. They don't know where to go. They don't know any information. They don't have the medical support. And so I want to raise awareness for it. I want to raise, I want it to be educated in schools. That's why I started a talk with my two sisters called Endo and Me. We go into schools and we give talks to teens about their bodies, male and female, because they need to know what goes on these conditions. And I just think it's too important when you have any type of platform. I think you have a responsibility to speak up about things that other people, you know, can't and don't have the listeners to. And I'm always a firm believer that you stand up for what you know about and can really talk about, as, you know, mainly. And for me, that's endometriosis. And obviously, Irish Women in Harmony is female artists and raising money. So I just feel like it's too important not to. So if I, you know, I put myself out there, you know, if it gets anyone talking or if it helps anyone, then that's everything.
So what do you say to somebody who is suffering while we're pushing? And that's why I'm here. I don't have endometriosis. I think this is an every woman, every person issue.
Mm-hmm. It is.
What do you say to somebody who's suffering? What's your advice?
My advice is, first of all, to know that the first red flag of endometriosis is that periods are not meant to be excruciatingly painful. So if you're having to, like, skip work, skip school, heavily medicate yourself, the medicines, you know, over-the-counter medicines aren't touching the pain. If you're having to do all that, you need to go see your doctor. It's very, very important to know that this, you know, back in the day, we were all told that period pain was normal. And it is, to an extent of, like, mild uncomfortableness, but to the extent of being at home keeled over in the bed, vomiting, diarrhea, excruciating pain, heavy bleeding, that's not. So the first thing you need to do is go see your doctor. And the next thing you need to do is, if they're not listening to you, I'm going to try to tell you it's just a bad period, go find another doctor. I spent 2 years searching for the doctor that would listen to me, and I found him privately, which is a shame. But your health is your wealth. And so for me, you know, just do whatever you need to do to get seen. It's just too important.
Yeah. And finally, because we do have Lily May here on your knee, because I know that gives great hope to people that you were able to become a mom. That's not the be all and end all for every woman, but for a lot of women I know, endometriosis or adenomyosis can be a real worry when it comes to fertility. But you have two beautiful girls.
I have my miracles, and I really credit with my doctor. He really helped me carry. I have adenomyosis inside my uterus, so it can make getting pregnant difficult and carrying difficult. And I went through my own fertility struggles. It wasn't all, you know, it wasn't plain sailing at all. But I really credit. I went to a doctor who I said, look, what can you do to help me? And he helped me. He gave me the medicines that helped me carry my children, and that's why I have them. I also looked into holistic methods, like I did fertility acupuncture, which I found incredible. And I couldn't recommend that more to people out there. Fertility acupuncturists, which they have specialists here of. I had therapy. I started seeing my body as a whole, kind of mindfulness pillars of, like, anti-inflammatory foods and everything. I really had to, you know, changed my lifestyle a lot when I got endometriosis, because I kind of used to eat whatever I wanted. I was skinny. All of a sudden, I was bloating. I was putting on weight, whatever. And it really, for me, came with a huge lifestyle change so that I amn't in pain. So there are home remedies that I'm not going to say it cures it, but can help you manage the symptoms better.
Yeah, holistic.
So holistic yeah. Approach. So definitely, I think when someone has endometriosis and fertility and everything, there's an amazing book by Dr. Larissa Corder called The Conception Plan. She's just launched a program, and she's an obstetrician gynecologist, but she also looks at the full body disease of endometriosis, the mental aspects, the whole body. It's not just a reproductive disease. And she has an amazing program for anyone who is struggling with their fertility or thinking about having a family. But I always say to people, I was so worried I wouldn't be able to get pregnant. I was so worried. And we did have struggles and losses and trauma with it. But I'm sitting here with my two girls because I just was like, I'm not giving up.
Well, thank you so much for being the epitome of using your voice, not only for us to listen to and enjoy, but everything you do for Irish women in music, Irish music, and also endometriosis. Thank you so much, and continued success to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Right, that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to all of my guests and to my team, producer Maurice O'Sullivan, to Hugh Keenan, Rory Galvin was on podcasts, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.